Blog Talk Radio.
From the far reaches of the known universe, we are proud to present Brother.
We're
From the far reaches of the known universe, we are proud to present Brother Harold Muhammad, soldier, scientist, scholar, Blog Talk Radio's finest, Not So Mad Science, on Black Hole Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, and welcome to tonight's edition of Not So Mad Science here on the Black Hole Radio Network with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, coming to you live once again and as always from the city of Detroit. Just because Berry Gordy took Motown to L.A. does not mean Detroit has lost its soul. Today, dear brothers and sisters, we will be having a conversation with noted writer, columnist, social activist, and commentator, James Gallego Davies. We will be discussing life amongst the indigenous peoples of America, the so-called Indians, the Native Americans. How has the coronavirus infected their lives on the reservation? How have the dramatic changes in the social structure affected the steps of self-determination and self-protection on the reservation? Have they come under fire? Have they come under attack? We will also hope that he'd be blessed to have with us this evening David El Chino Trusty, who is a Native American activist and freedom fighter right here from the Detroit area. So let's get right into it. Brother James, are you on the line with us?
Yes, I am.
Praise be to Allah. Brother James is... I know I said he's a writer, a columnist, a social activist, and a commentator. I believe he's more than that. He brings a voice to a condition and a problem to a part of the original human family that we don't get to hear of too often. By definition, some would say he's a prophet or a spiritual guide. But that would be in the modern language of definitions. I don't think there is a definition for what he represents and the voice he brings to our Native American brothers and sisters. So to that end, Brother James, please tell us a little about yourself.
Well, first I want to thank you for having me on. I was born and raised in the Black Hills of South Dakota. I'm an enrolled member of the Oglala Lakota Nation, which is located on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, which is one of five Lakota reservations in western South Dakota. And I've been a journalist all my life. My family is heavily into journalism. My uncle was the founder of the Native American Journalists Association, of which I'm also a member.
Now, for me,
that's my
Brother
bio.
James, yes, sir. For me, that term reservation is not a term of or a word of endearment or something to be proud of. That, to me, is a word which identifies an overwhelming preponderance of being into forced isolation. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah, I would. I think one of the problems, Harold, is that they have a mentality on reservations that they consider the reservation to be sacred. I think a lot of that has been conditioned into their mind through the education system, which they do not control, which the dominant culture controls. In fact, all the land that surrounds them, the hundreds of millions of acres that was taken from them, that is their sacred land. The reservation is a holding pen. It's a prison. And I think that just like dogs who are leashed to a pole, if you never test the leash, then you think you've got a lot of freedom and you think
right.
that you're in a pretty good position. But once you strain that leash, then you realize where you are and that you are trapped to a pole. And I think that these reservations represent a leash and a pole. And too many, they create within the tribe a myopic echo chamber of small-mindedness that keeps the tribe from recognizing what they need to do to improve their lives and recognizing who their enemies are and what their enemies are up to and how to stop them. So that's, you know, I agree totally with you about your definition of a reservation.
Now, as I understand it, it's roughly according to the 2010 census that approximately 22% of America's 5.2 million Native Americans live on what is being called tribal lands, which is just another word for or phraseology for the reservation. And those living conditions on the reservations, to quote Dr. Conrad Worrell, who called the Black American ghetto the reservation. If you live in a project, you're on the reservation. If you're living in public housing inside a fenced area, you're on the reservation. So I'm looking at the parallel to what some third world countries would look like.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and that's true on the reservation. It's also true off the reservation. So if you go to the nearest big city, which is a rapid city, I'd say in a metro area of about 100,000 people, you've got about 25,000 people in that area from the various tribes. And I was born and raised into that environment. And we were basically raised in an Indian ghetto. And we were raised on welfare and food stamps. And we considered ourselves lucky that we weren't on the reservation because it was much worse. And a lot of that has to do with the structure of the reservation, but it also has to do with the IRA, the Indian Reorganization Act and Forced Government from 1934, which Roosevelt thought was a good idea. He meant well, and he wanted to give tribes self-determination. However, those people who were best prepared to step in and become the people who became our leaders in those reservation governments were those who had best internalized the values of their BIA masters. And it soon became apparent that they were simply filtering the wishes and the ideas and values of the BIA through their own personal prism. And it resulted in corruption and dysfunction, and made many tribes their own worst enemies. And so I would agree the conditions are terrible on the reservation. They're terrible for tribal members who live off the reservation as well.
You know, as I've been doing my research to prepare for tonight's show, I'm looking at numbers for unemployment, numbers for sickness, diabetes and such. And I might as well be looking at the numbers for Ma and Pa Black America. There's nothing different. So I'm reminded of the words of the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad. In our lessons, we're taught that, you know, the question is asked, who is the original man? The original man is the Asiatic Black man, the maker, the owner, the cream of the planet Earth, God of the universe. And then he added something. He said, with the 2 million Indians, in terms of the total number of original people here in this wilderness that we call North America. So that line of division that says we're two separate people did not exist between Black America and the Native American. Two people from the same family just traveled two different ways to get here, one in the hold of a slave ship and one across the land bridge. So I'm not looking at a separate person. I'm looking at a life and an existence that mirrors my own in almost every capacity, the poverty, the sickness, the need for better conditions, the need for greater means to take care of yourselves and your family, all being cut off by the same hidden hand called the American government.
Yeah.
That's disturbing.
And the same racism, you know, racism too. the sting of now there is a difference that I want to point out between racism against black people and racism against tribal people here. And the racism I experience in South Dakota is every bit as bad as the racism black people experience wherever they're at. However, when I leave South Dakota, I don't experience racism as badly as a black person, regardless of where they go. And we've had many black people come here through the Air Force Base. They experience the same level of intense racism. So I'm not going to pretend that racism against the tribal people of North America is as bad as it is against black people. It's not. But anytime you experience racism, for you personally, it's bad. And so I felt the sting of it many times in my life.
Well, Brother James, racism by any definition against whoever it is bad. It's no good. It's not right. And it must be expunged from society. However, looking at that and bringing us to the purpose of tonight's conversation, you know, we've seen recently, only sporadically in the news, where some of the reservations have taken an aggressive and a forward stance to stem the tide of the COVID-19 virus extending itself into the reservation, onto the res, where they've blocked people at the highway to check them, to monitor the movements of someone who may be or may not be sick in order to track something. I forget the term that they want to use medically to track the virus, but they took an aggressive measure to track it. Now you have the governor of the state of, I think it's just in South Dakota, that is pushing back, but her pushback isn't what it seems in the language on surface. There's something deeper below that.
Oh, she has deeply ulterior motives, and one thing about those ulterior motives is they are well planned and well executed by very capable, intelligent, devious, and dangerous people. So it's she herself may not represent that. I think she's a very nice lady. But I think that she is a tool being used by them, and the principal architect of that strategy is a man named Kevin Cramer, who's the U.S. representative from North Dakota. Now, he's the main one behind the attack, the assault on tribal sovereignty, and that's what this is all about. It's not about COVID-19. They're trying to get inside the borders with state jurisdiction and take away the sovereignty of the tribes in North and South Dakota. And they've been trying it for a long time, and they think that with Trump as president, they've come up with a strategy that just might work. And this is just the opening salvo in it. My problem is
what
the tribes are playing right into it by not realizing that what she's up to.
I thought you had dropped off. Yes, sir. What are they after?
What are they at?
Yeah, no, what are they after?
Oh, they
Why
are after
such
the tribe
a huge
sovereignty.
Push?
So they want to take away tribal sovereignty so they can get state jurisdiction inside the reservation borders. So if you got 2 or 3 minutes, I can explain the history of that.
You have all the time you need to take.
Okay, let's go back to the early 1950s. So there's a law that's passed called Public Law 280. And what that did is Congress took many of the reservations in the larger states like Minnesota, California, and they gave the state jurisdiction over those reservations. Now, some of those reservations were left outside in federal jurisdiction, and that was the reservations in North and South Dakota. They were part of that, the Lakota reservations. So these reservations, the way it went was if the state decided that they wanted jurisdiction inside these reservations, then they would hold a statewide referendum and all the citizens of the state could vote on it. And if 2/3 agreed, then the state would take over jurisdiction of the res. However, the problem was is the Republicans decided in 1964 that that's exactly what they were going to do. And so they set it all up, they got it on the ballot, and then the state Supreme Court told them, sorry, if you do this, you are responsible for the whole shebang. If you go onto that reservation and you try to take sovereignty over just on the highways, you can't do it. You've got to take over the entire judicial system. You've got to manage it. You've got to fund it. And they didn't want that at all. They didn't want that burden. So they were in the ludicrous position of having to campaign against their own referendum. And they got it defeated. And so the tribe heaved a sigh of relief. 4 years later, the civil rights legislation came out with an amendment that said that in future referendums, when you're trying to take state jurisdiction inside the reservation boundary, you need two-thirds of the tribal consent, not the state consent. And there's no tribe anywhere on this planet that is going to voluntarily give over jurisdiction to the state in a referendum. Because if you go back to 1866, there was a Supreme Court ruling where the Chief Justice said that every state where a tribe resides, their worst enemy is that state. So even those men born way back at the close of the 18th century, even those men knew that a tribe's greatest enemy was the state, not the federal government. Not that the federal government is the tribe's friend. It's not. But compared to the state, the tribe can actually get some protection from the federal government.
Right.
And so that's who Kristi Noem is, and that's what she's up to. And she wants to come up with a ruse, a pretext, to get the state's big, ugly boot across that reservation line and keep it there.
Now,
and if she does that, they'll consider her a hero.
We all know that the state, the federal government, they don't do anything or want anything unless there's something there for them to gain. What is on the reservation that they want so badly? That they want control of
the
land?
They want the land. They want control of the land. They want control of tens of thousands of acres. They want to become in, they want to come in there and start up an economy. Now, not everything they do is bad. So let's pick a nearby town, a white town called Winner.
Mm-hmm.
Winner is a fairly racist town, but it has learned over the years how to get along with reservation people. It has a very solid economy, and it's got about 6,000-7,000 people. And if you go onto the reservation and find a similar town like Pine Ridge, where my family, the reservation my family comes from, it has an economy about a tenth the size of Winter, if that. And so there is no economy. There is the tribes do not know how to set up an economy and maintain it like these other white towns do. So
okay.
If the state was able to get inside the reservations, they would be able to economically exploit it to their own advantage. They could tax everybody. They could get at the natural resources. There is on the opportunity, if you go to Fort Berthold Reservation, which is not a Lakota reservation in North Dakota, they sold the energy rights underhandedly. The tribal leadership snuck behind the backs of the tribal membership and sold the energy rights underneath Lake Sakakawea to an energy company in New York City for almost $1 billion. But they didn't get $1 billion. They just, the middle company there, the go-between got the money, and they kicked back money to the tribe, but not directly to the tribe, but under the table payments to many tribal members who then went and built big houses on the Missouri River. So that's how deep the corruption is, and that's how much money can be made. And so, if you look at almost a billion that you can get off a reservation, and then you go over to Black Hills, which are huge, they're 100 miles long, they're 50 miles wide. Their yearly economy is 9 billion, so 10 times less than what any state could get if it went in and exploited a reservation. So that's really the motivation.
So the issue becomes individual corruption as to what is in the best interest of the tribal community.
Right. The tribe has a tendency, and I don't know why they do it. First of all, the thing they loved the most in this world was basketball. So whenever someone is a basketball star, everybody knows him. You know, it's the thing about tribes is everybody tends to be related to each other and everybody tends to know each other. So this guy, if he wants to go into politics, he's going to be tribal chairman. And that's exactly what happened up at Fort Berthold. Tex Hall was a great basketball player, big, tall, 6'5" or 6" guy. He just waltzed in there, and it wasn't so much he was corrupt as everything around him was just a big machine of total corruption. And the tribe supports these people, and they don't learn their lesson. They get rid of one corrupt guy, and they'll just bring in another. The kind of people that you and I respect, you know, the kind of people with, who can think critically, who have an intellect, who have an abiding sense of principle, these people do not do well in the reservation environment. And so they leave. They take all of their skill and all of their knowledge and all of their capacity to help the tribe with them, and they move off to some city. And then the tribe is stuck with their half-smart second cousin Frank running things, and of course it doesn't work well.
It doesn't work well at all. A quick question, and I want to deviate away from the politics for a moment. Has the coronavirus taken hold on the reservation with respect to sickness and the loss of life?
It hasn't, but these in this in our area. But if you go to New Mexico and Arizona, and I'm also Pueblo as well as Lakota. So my relatives from New Mexico and their area. It's pretty, by comparison to the rest of the country, it's at a slightly higher level. Now, in South Dakota, the tribes here are so isolated that coronavirus hasn't gotten into the tribes, and that's why they put up the roadblocks, is they don't want it to.
Right.
You know, you talked earlier about diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I have 11 brothers and sisters, and I'm the only one that doesn't have it. And my mom had it, my aunt had it, all my uncles have it. Everyone, just about everyone gets it. I don't know why I don't have it, but I'm the only one that doesn't. And so tribes are very leery about the white man's disease. In the past, they have suffered greatly for it. Back in Spanish flu times, they died in droves. They are very leery of it, and they wanted to be preemptive. Part of the reason that Harold Frazier at the Cheyenne River Reservation wanted to be preemptive is he says, we have 8 beds on the entire reservation. 8 beds. That's all the BIA will give us, the Indian Health Service. What are we supposed to do? Now they've been sitting, waiting for COVID-19 funding, and they finally got it. I think they got $22 million. On Cheyenne River, but it took forever to get there. And when
that
it gets there, the mechanisms in place to get it out, to turn those $22 million into things that will help people in this crisis, those are all set up by corrupt elements to siphon that money off to themselves. Oh, I got a new pickup. Instead of helping some elderly couple get the help they need. And so all of these concerns about coronavirus are what bothers me. It's not so much that the disease is doing anything now, but it is poised like a buzzard on a branch to do terrible things if things take a turn for the worse. And the tribe needs to be in a preemptive position to protect itself, and that's all it's really asking. And Nome has no sympathy for that.
What would you say is the distinction between yourself as an individual who did not contract diabetes and the rest of your family that picked up diabetes? What's different?
I was always into sports. You know, I was always fit. And I didn't smoke. I didn't drink. Most of my relatives are alcoholics. Almost most of them smoke. And I ate a fairly healthy diet most of my life. And I think that the damage to the pancreas, most people don't understand why tribal people get diabetes. It's not because the pancreas doesn't handle, doesn't work. It overworks. So it is used to a Neolithic diet and a Paleolithic diet. And when the body hasn't had a chance to change its metabolism over. And so just like they contract diseases at a much higher level, they also can't process foods in the same way. So like milk, I can't process milk, so I have to avoid it as much as I can. And almost everybody on the reservation is lactose intolerant. And so when you get to the diet, it makes the pancreas overwork itself. So by the time you get to be 35 or 30, you know, 45, somewhere in those that area, the pancreas wears out and you get diabetes. And what I was able to do is I'm no physically different than my siblings is I just did not participate in that kind of self-destructive behavior. You know, I recognized I was susceptible. I listened to the doctors at the Indian hospital when they told me that you have to really watch your weight and you have to do this or that, you know. But I will admit that in any family, for whatever reason, it doesn't matter what it is, some members are just lucky and they're immune to this whatever it is. And in this case, I just haven't contracted it and probably never will at this point. But it is a very big problem.
I find it real weird and strange because I've had, you know, over the last two or three days, conversations with people saying whose position was that, well, they live on a reservation. You know, they have all this land. Why don't they just farm the land and grow their own food? And my response is, without any evidence to say one way or the other, but my instincts tell me it's not really that simple. The land that you're on isn't really farmable kind of land.
I think that a lot of it is, and this isn't discussed very much, but people always ask me, you know, why do they do what they do? You know, why do Indians act the way they act? I think that because the spirit and honor of the tribe is broken. And the structures of the society that had developed over thousands of years were not only stripped from them in a matter of weeks in 1877, but were declared illegal. So the sister wife matriarchal network was broken up. So that relationships had to adhere to dominant culture standards. The culture of shunning, which is how they disciplined everybody. If somebody was acting up, if somebody was a jerk, you just ignored them. And I mean, everybody did it. So no one would talk to this poor guy for like two or three days and straighten him out. That was completely eliminated. So if we go back to the year, like say 1870, the likelihood that you're going to commit a violent act or steal from somebody in the tribe or kill somebody in the tribe or rape some woman in the tribe is practically non-existent. You're going to do those things to people outside the tribe, but within the tribe, you're not going to do those things. But if you go forward 30 years, the likelihood that you would do that to another tribal member by the time you reach the 20th century is very high. And so my opinion is that the reason that this happened is because the social framework that the tribe had constructed by over tens of thousands of years was eliminated forcibly in a matter of weeks. And how can any people be expected to retain their dignity and their sense of purpose and self-worth when that's taken from them? And I think that that is why they can't get involved in big projects and do things the way they see their white neighbors doing them. because they don't, it's too heartbreaking internally to subject themselves to that kind of humiliation. And that's, I think that's how they view it inside. I'm not saying that's a correct way to look at it, but I think that I felt it internally myself, and it took me 10 or 15 years of wasted adulthood to get over it. And not every tribal member, in fact, most of them, are not, they're not going to get over it, and they don't. They eventually destroy themselves, and the life expectancy on my reservation for a male who was born at the time I was born, born in, under the conditions I was born, is 48 years.
You got to be kidding me.
No, that's it.
48 years of age. That is way too young. Way too young. You know, I'm taken aback by the parallels of the Black ghetto and the Indian reservation. There was a time prior to Reconstruction, the period of time just after slavery, where Black people were leaving the South, heading north, going to other parts of the country. We opened businesses. We created our own little townships that thrived. And the white neighbors in towns next door, they weren't doing so well because we stayed within our own network, and the monies that we produced stayed within that community, and it grew. We hear the mythology of Black Wall Street. We hear the mythology of the town in Florida called Rosewood. We hear the mythology of the Harlem Renaissance, when Black businesses were at its highest in New York City. Something actively was done to change the mindset of the people. And with this, we're fighting a war of this psychological warfare. What was used on the reservation to create that mental change? Yes, okay, you're coming from 1888, you're coming forward in time, and as you get past the 19th century, coming into the 20th century, something happened.
Yeah.
Something happened. I'm trying to find that thing that happened. I know in the Black community, we were going too long, too strong, too much good was being done, and then heroin was introduced through the entertainment community. And then when heroin was not enough, the Harlem Renaissance movement going forward, where Black history became something that you involved yourself in, and you went home and taught it to your children after hearing the preachers on the corner doing their thing. You went home and you talked about it with your family. Something else came behind it. Then we got hit with crack. And then after crack, the neighborhoods died. The Black nationalists became Black intellectuals because, as they say, they got jobs and they forgot what they were fighting for. Is there a similar pattern of behavior amongst our Indian brothers and sisters where those who had the charge and the responsibility of keeping the people invigorated quit? Because children don't develop into thug life until the parent of that child's teaching the history.
Yeah.
Somebody quit on their post.
Yeah. If you go to the reservation, there are different clans, different groups of people. My mom was born at Wounded Knee in 1930. And she was born in a part of the reservation where it's isolated, and there's no politics there. People just get up every day and do what they can to get by. And there's a trading post there, and you do your best. She was, you know, grew up during the Depression, so you just did your best to get to survive. However, it's not the same if you go 40 miles down the road to Pine Ridge Agency, where most of the tribe lives. There you have the hogs at the trough. So you have entire clans of people who are devoted entirely into finding every creative way they can to exploit all the largesse they get from the BIA and get as much as they can for themselves, and very little of it filters out to the isolated corners of the reservation. And those people create an environment where stealing and violence is common, and where, you know, 70% of the people are alcoholics. And that was bad. People thought alcoholism was bad, but then came meth. And meth is devastating the reservations in South Dakota. It is everywhere. And I long for the days when all we had, when I, you know, when I was a boy, I walked to the park in Rapid City and my uncle was drunk under a tree. I longed for those days. I felt so terrible seeing him there. But meth is many, many magnitudes worse. And I think that that is the and people know who the meth dealers are. And they, and if you say anything, then a car shows up on the reservation with Arizona or Colorado plates, and some Hispanic gentlemen get out and shoot you in the face. So they shot Vinnie Brewer in the face. They shot Todd White Bull in the face, all because they objected to some of the meth dealings that were going on the reservation. So that's the reality that the reservation has to operate under. It's in the power of those who are in control on the tribal councils to stop this meth epidemic if they really wanted to. But most of the people who are involved in it, either stealing so they can support their meth habit, or dealing so they can support their family or their relatives, and they're not going to turn their relatives in.
You know, what's peculiar about that is the meth is brought in from the outside and then processed on the reservation.
Yeah, because if you're Hispanic,
you know,
because
you said,
and, you know,
some Hispanic guy brings it in, but he's not even a source.
No, no, we know that the funding, everyone knows that the true funding for all of these huge drug operations comes from the 1% who own and operate our country. They're the ones with the pockets, and they're the ones with the resources, and they're the ones who can establish and protect those networks from law enforcement. For me, I know that these people are ultimately it. But what happens is this Fiola, and that's what we call Hispanics on our reservation. I've been called that my whole life because I'm not just Lakota, I'm also Hispanic. You know, Gallego is, mm-hmm. Is a corrupted reservation spelling of the Hispanic surname Gallego, G-A-L-L-E-G-O. And so they come, Hispanics can come onto our reservation. And genetically, there's very little difference between them and us. Most of them are Indio. You know, most of them are some tribe from, and they have just as much Indian blood as I do. So you can't tell them
right.
apart from anyone, and they can just blend into that reservation. Anyone else, if white people or black people or Chinese people try to come into the res, they stand out like sore thumbs. But Hispanics can just slide right through. You can't tell them from anybody, and they are temperamentally and behaviorally similar to Indians, and so they develop really tight bonds, and you just can't keep the drugs out.
That's a very sick mind, right, James? That's
now
a very sick mind. Because you're killing your own tree. You're killing your own tree with no regard for your own personal existence.
Yeah.
Wow.
Every person on, and I can speak with this from personal experience, is that for most of my life, I've been my own worst enemy. I don't need any white people hating on me or restricting where I can go or what I can do. Nobody is a bigger enemy to myself than me. And that's true of most reservations and true of most tribal members. Getting past that, growing past that, learning, and I think a lot of it is just what I'm doing right now, talking to you on this phone. This is what tribes need to do. They need to meet people like yourself. They need to have a meeting of the minds and exchange their ideas about politics, about spirituality, about principle, you know, of everything. And then maybe we have the network capacity to resist what we know is going on. You know, we are not marginalized because we're lazy or because we're stupid or because we have bad character. We are marginalized because it's a deliberate strategy by the people who own and operate our country to keep us here. And we have to find ways to fight against it. And we can't do it by ourselves. And I always say that you see these Indian activists all over the place, and it's great that they're active and that they're trying to change things. But the biggest friend that anyone has in a tribe is some person of conscience who isn't a tribal member, who comes from the rest of the 7.5 billion people on this planet. Without those people of principle, the tribes wouldn't even exist. Back in 1890, L. Frank Baum, who wrote Wizard of Oz, he was an editor at a weekly newspaper in Aberdeen, South Dakota. And he wrote two very infamous, evil editorials calling for the extermination of the Lakota Nation. And most agreed with what he said, who were in the state, and they would have exterminated the Indians. The only thing that stopped them was across this country were enough people of conscience, at that time all white, but now they're not all white. We have a great groundswell of people of conscience in this country. And people like Helen Hunt Jackson, she wrote a book called A Century of Dishonor, about the treatment of Indians. These white people of conscience are the only thing that kept the people in South Dakota after the Wounded Knee massacre from attacking the tribes and destroying them, because they were certainly ginned up to do so by newspaper editors like L. Frank Baum. And so I think in the long run, what's going to help the reservations is their ability to get out and understand how the rest of the world works, how things are in Detroit, not just on the reservation, and get to know you and people like you on an intimate level, and not just sit on their little in their little isolated hovels on the reservation and expect to understand how the world works by crawling up on top of a mountain and starving themselves for 3 days. I'm not saying that there isn't some benefit from spirituality like that. Mm-hmm. Only something that helps you go out into the real world and get something done.
Well, I'm thankful that when I moved here to Detroit, let me do a little homework first. The phone lines are open. This is Not So Mad Science with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network with our on-air guest, James Gayago Davies, from the Lakota Nation in South Dakota. The phone lines are open. If you hit that number one to let the engineer know that you'd like to ask a question to our host or like to make a comment and put it out there, please hit the number one and let them know, and we'll get you on as quickly as we can to ask your questions. I am concerned, and my concern socially, theologically, and psychologically is we have enough, more than enough. I would say a preponderance of ability. A lot of people complain about former President Barack Obama. You know, whether you're a fan of his or not, his presidency is one thing. His representation of that presidency is another. His representation says that we as a people have the capacity to lead and to lead with dignity. That's something that most black children will have never seen in their lifetime or ever heard of. Would have never known about that until he came. Not that Jesse Jackson didn't run in the 80s. He didn't get very far, but he ran. Not that Shirley Chisholm didn't try during the latter part of the 60s coming into the 70s. She tried. She ran for president. Jesse wasn't the first, nor was Shirley Chisholm the first. Others have run. But our Indian brothers and sisters are not limited to a television show about Billy Sims running in the Olympics or running the 800 meters, because that's all you ever heard of. It's not the movie Billy Jack, like that is some great historical thing, where you see an occasional movie about Custer getting his behind whooped. That is not the Native American. That is a representation from someone who dictates the narrative. But there is talent, there is intellect, there is ability, and there is a structure of strength and integrity in our Native American brothers and sisters to lift themselves up with help. We got help. The black man and woman and the Native American man and woman got help from a man who came from the east to the west to find a tribe of people that was lost, that the rest of the world forgot about. We were less than human beings, one-third of a human being by definition, according to the law. Someone came and told us, no, you're God. You can stand up and do for yourself. So if anything that I do, as my brother David told me, he said, Brother Harold, don't you let anybody after we've met step in between me and you as if you don't mean anything to me and I don't mean something to you. You remember me, for I will remember you unto my death. We have the capacity to help raise each other up. We just have to want to do it. I know I do. So I reached out to my friend to reach out to you, and we got connected. This will not be the last time you be here to share your insight, the so-called Indians of America. There's too much information. There's a wealth of abilities there that have not been tapped. You have land. We have capacity to do things. There's no reason why one can't be added to one to make two. Because this world is coming down. This coronavirus is proof positive that America lacks the ability to care for its own. And by this time, we got a question on the floor. Caller, state your name, and welcome to Not So Mad Science.
Good evening. My name's Angela, and I'm from Washington, D.C. And I'm so glad, Brother Muhammad, that you had this gentleman on tonight. I've learned so much that I had no idea about. Because of the job that I do, I work for the federal government in the Department of Homeland Security. And one of the concerns that I have in my work daily is the food shortages, the health care, and the lack of jobs that are available to Native Americans in this country. I recently was able to participate in a conference call with the Indian Health Service. And the number of tribal dignitaries that got on and were able to give information, like there was $8 billion given to, I think it was the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And they were supposed to disseminate that money to the tribes in America. It was supposed to be all given away by the 23rd of April. And this particular tribal leader said, I want to know why you have only given away half of the money, and it's May 6th. Of course, the person who could answer that question had gotten off the line, and so, of course, the people who were standing in, oh, well, we have your contact information, sir, and so we'll be getting back to you, or we'll get the right person to get back to you. So, of course, no answer was given online. So my question is, what can we, as individual citizens who are not on the reservation, who are not part of your tribal family per se, what can we do to assist with getting the health care, the food, and the job opportunities that are going to be coming around with 40 million people unemployed? What can we do to help the Native American be more successful in all the areas where you've been so eloquent and so well versed about?
Oh, well, thanks for the question, Angela. One of the problems is, like, let's take this COVID-19 funding that the tribes got. My tribe got $58 million. Cheyenne River, just up 120 miles north of us, they're slightly smaller. They got $22 million. My worry is there is not a framework. You can throw money at the tribes all day long, but until there is a reliable network to distribute that money and to provide real programs and opportunities for people, then really it's just money that's going to tempt people, and they're going to gradually take it. My feeling is that outside groups need to come onto the reservation and establish relationships, business relationships, that are independent of the tribe. In other words, don't let the tribe manage those things. Don't let them have control over that. Invite the tribe to participate with you in whatever it is, and let them bring whatever funding or expertise they have that will make your project a going concern. I think then that money will filter back to the reservation. And then the people on the reservation will see that this is a structured, sensible process that I can involve myself in, and I can learn how these things work. You know, when I was a kid, I never tasted steak until I was 13 years old. You know, I never tasted shrimp until I was 13. I was in my 20s before I tasted lobster. So I had no exposure to the outside world. I didn't know how to write checks. I didn't even know what a check was. You know, I'd seen other people, white people, writing them at the counter, but I didn't know what they were. And I had to teach all of this to myself. No, my mom didn't teach me any of this, and my relatives didn't. And, you know, over the course of 15 wasted years, you know, from the time I was 15 till I was 30, I taught myself all of these basic things that the mainstream culture teaches their kids by the time they're 16 or 17. And I think that this is what prevents people like yourself from going in and having a good, safe, interactive relationship with people on the reservation to accomplish good for everybody. So, you know, when tribal people can reach the point where they can go out and meet someone named Angela from Washington, D.C., and be gracious and shake her hand and talk to her and not shy away from her, and know enough about how the world works to know what kind of person you are just from talking to you for 5 minutes, know enough about how the world works to recognize an opportunity that you're presenting them with that will benefit you and the tribe, then I think that things will get better. But until those basic fundamental blocks are laid in place, then tribes will always be standing there doing the only thing they know how to do, which is take handouts and stand there with this money. And the only thing you do with money that you don't invest or anything is you just spend it, and then it's gone. You know, and you can take that money and you can do something with it. But I really think that it's unfair to point fingers at the tribe and say, oh, you don't do that. Because in my own case, I didn't know how to do it. And I was not your average tribal member. You know, I had a mind and I had talents. I had gifts. And even that was not near enough to rescue me from that circumstance without a lot of suffering and hard work. So I think that that's the major problem. And the best way for people like yourself is to get involved with another organization who can then contact a reservation and have a sit down and create a relationship that the tribe does not control that will benefit you and the tribe. And I think that if enough of that happens and the net effect over time would be to build an economy on the reservation and to educate the people there, not turn them into brown white people, but turn them into tribal members who understand how the nation at large works.
That is a that's an interesting way to view that. Don't make the relationship with the tribe, but develop a relationship with someone who's on that reservation who has the tribe's best interest.
Yeah.
And let that grow so that it benefits the tribe. You know, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad would always tell us, he said, you don't need my permission to go do right. Go do it. And once you've got it done, come back and tell me about it so that you can show someone else how to do what you did.
Yeah,
this
has
been
it would be great
for
if there were.
Tonight. Go ahead, bro.
Oh, it would be great if the tribes understood that. What I think many people on the reservation, because of the isolation, do not understand that there are people like you and Angela out there by the millions. They don't understand that, and that nothing keeps them from reaching out and connecting with you except themselves. And you know, and in most of my life, that's how I've been. I've been very insular, and I've been very just, you know, I don't trust anything that the society at large presents to me on its face value, because for most of my life, I've been too ignorant to understand what that means, what its promise is, what its threat is. I can't process them. But as I educated myself the hard way over time, and I came to understand that, you know, it's a two-way street. You know, if I want to go out into the world and get something from it, then I have to take something from the, I have to give something to the world as well. It's a give and take relationship. And I think most tribes always think it's only about themselves because that's just the habit that they've fallen into.
Yeah, you reminded me of something that I was taught as a youngster when I went to school at Muhammad University of Islam in New York. And we were told that truth in its for its own sake is just truth. But how that truth is used dictates whether it is good truth or bad truth. Not necessarily a lie, but good truth or bad truth. What does that mean? If my brother came and told me, hey, so-and-so took something of yours over there. That's coming from my brother. I know the reason. I know the source. I understand why he's telling me. But when the enemy comes and tells me, hey, so-and-so over there took something of yours, I got to question the enemy. Why are you telling me that he took it? What's your motivation? What's your reasoning? So Honorable Elijah Muhammad would tell us, he said, consider the source when you get information from your enemy. Not that the information is not sound. Take what is good and use it for good's sake. But consider why. Is there a price tag attached to the information that he's giving you? Does he want something in return? Is he using that information to get up next to you to separate you from your brother, who the one who took your stuff? Because the minute you allow them to step in between you to mediate a problem between family, that family now becomes broken. They cut the wedge through, and you allow them to do it. It happens in the black community, and from what I'm hearing you say to me, Brother James, it is happening on the reservation, because then that becomes a source by which greed is dispersed and goes into the pockets of a few instead of to the hearts of the many.
Yeah, there's a meme on Facebook, one of my favorites, because it's so true. It shows three people sitting there with cookies in front of them, and one of them's got like 50 cookies, and one of them's got three cookies, And one of them doesn't even have a cookie, and he's sitting over there. And the one with 50 cookies is saying to the one with 3 cookies, "You watch him. He's trying to take one of your cookies." And really, that's how it is in this country. You know, they like to pit people with 3 cookies against people with no cookies while they sit on their 50. And they don't want to share any of it.
They take all the cookies. While you've been fighting with each other, they come in and take what you left unprotected. Well, Brother James, it has been truly an honor and a pleasure to not only make your acquaintance, but to begin the roots of a budding friendship, because I know David is going to make sure that I stay in touch with you, because I understand he has a book coming out pretty soon. And I want to review that book and get him on the air to talk about it some. But I want to visit the reservation. I'm going to come to South Dakota and visit the reservation and to see with my own eyes what it is that I may have in myself that I can share. And, you know, we're in the world of modern technology in the digital age, but that is nothing compared to seeing it with your own eyes. Got to get off the horse and get down on the ground to feel what the ground feels like with your own feet.
Well, when you come to Lakota country, there's 3 different areas you should visit and to get the whole picture. One is the reservation. 2 is the urban Lakota community in Rapid City. And 3 are the little towns on the borders of the reservation where Lakota and white people live together. And those 3 environments, you'll experience every aspect of what it's like to be a Lakota and live in South Dakota. You'll get a very clear picture of how it operates.
I can well imagine. I have this picture welling up in my head. Those are 3 totally different environments altogether.
They are. Yeah.
3 different worlds.
And each one has its positives and negatives.
Mm-hmm. So you brought me full circle, and we're going to come back to this coronavirus because it is not raging in full bloom on the reservation. And that is due to a
couple
of things.
Not in South Dakota.
Not in South Dakota. The isolation and this disconnect from America at large, which tells me that the movement of the coronavirus throughout the rest of America, the U.S., is a planned attack. There is a virologist who works for the National Institute of Health, who is one of the leading virologists that is working towards a vaccine. And her words were that bug. It is a bug designed to kill people of color, black people in particular. She was censored to a degree by the NIH, but they didn't want her to stop working. They didn't fire her. They just told her she couldn't speak publicly about things anymore.
Well, you know, there's an Israeli historian, Yuval Noah Harari, and he talks all the time about how technology can be used for wonderful things, but that's just one side of the sword. You can also turn that same technology and do terrible, terrible things with it. And I think we tend to forget that the very things that we rely on every day and that have positive, beneficial uses that save millions of lives can be easily twisted by a sick mind to kill people.
We see it done
every
day.
They have the resources and they have the strategy and they see the benefit for themselves. And I think that they think people like you and I are superfluous and they're not doing anything really wrong because our lives are just a waste of time anyway. So, you know, anything they do to us is they can live with their conscience.
You have to have a conscience to feel bad.
Yeah, I really believe. Well, they have a conscience for each other, just not for anyone else, anyone outside their club privilege. So,
before we close out this particular segment, because I know you, your schedule is like David's, is always rolling. What is the biggest suggestion that you could make to the listening audience at large that's hearing this program and be listening to it through the archives? What's the bridge that you suggest we all cross one to the other?
One thing I've noticed about when I grew up is how many of my favorite comedians were black. And I realized that humor was a major component in cultures, gallows humor. You know, how do they cope with all the tragedy and heartbreak of their lives? And humor is a major component. And the reason that resonated with me is because that's exactly how it is on the reservation. Humor is the main thing that tribes use when they communicate. And so I think I would like to say to most of the people in the country is, when you come, find a way to establish a line of communication with not only Black America, but with tribal America, by communicating with them in the things that they enjoy the most. You know, if they offer, like if you come to a reservation and they offer you something, mm-hmm. even if you don't want it, take it, because they're sharing with you because they want to be your friend. They don't share with people they don't want to be friends with. And if they laugh or joke around you, it's because they like you, not because they're being smart alecks. And learning how to communicate, I think, is the major thing. If disparate groups learn to recognize the qualities in the other and learn what is important to each other and how to communicate on those basic things, you know, I think that that's the most important thing, because it opens the door for lots of other spiritual, economic, philosophical connections that won't happen if you can't handle basic conversation with each other. If you don't get pleasure, if you don't feel like, oh, I can't wait to talk to that person again, then I don't think anything ever builds or lasts.
Well, Brother James, as we begin to close this program out this evening, I want to thank you so very much for sharing your insights, your heart with us here on Not So Mad Science. And the listening audience, I pray that I'm speaking for you, that we do want you to come back sometime in the near future, because we cannot allow the road less traveled to be traveled less anymore. We're on the road, so we got to keep walking down it back and forth, one to the other. And I can promise you for myself that hopefully when David's book come out, that both of us will be able to talk to him about the new book that he just wrote, to get an insight into the mind of David Trustee here in the Detroit area. And I am going to do my best to endeavor to get to South Dakota and see my family on the reservations and how they live, and bring something back to share with the listening audience of Not So Mad Science on the Black Hole Radio Network. So I thank you, thank you, thank you for your time. I thank you for your patience with me as a interviewer. And if my audience has any other question, has a question, ping in right now before we lose, brother. If not, we want to thank you for sharing your time with us, and we want to welcome you back as soon as possible.
Well, I enjoy the comeback, and thank you for having me. And it's been a pleasure talking with you, Harold. And hopefully we'll talk again soon.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much.
Okay. This is thank you.
Brother Harold Muhammad here in the Black Hole. Yes, sir. Go ahead. I didn't want to cut you off.
Oh, no.
Okay.
That's okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I thought I was done. But I enjoyed it, and I'd like very much to talk again on some other topic that is of mutual interest to both of us.
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
Okay.
We'll find one.
All right.
We'll make one if it don't exist. You're welcome, sir.
Yeah, we will. you have a good night.
Okay. This is Not So Mad Science with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. We have been speaking with noted writer, columnist, social activist, and commentator, James Gallego Davies of the Lakota tribe of South Dakota. we will do what we can to make sure that he comes back to share the Indian experience, or the so-called Indian experience, with us. That is all I have for us today. So I will be closing out with the words that I always do from that great immortal black pastor of the Abyssinian Baptist Church. Keep the faith, baby. Keep the faith. God loves you. We'll see you next week. Goodbye.